Thank you for your patience.
Legislative.
I'd like to call to order the meeting of the Legislation Committee. It's Monday, March 15th. It's about 1:45. I apologize for the late start. We are joined by legislators Burton, Rogowski, Burroughs, Harcum, Pinto, Myers, and myself, John Yona, Chair, as well as a number of guests. We had a number of follow-ups from the last meeting, which are reflected in the minutes, although we haven't voted on them yet, which I'd like to get to. But we have a visitor from Nassau County Human Rights Commission, Margalie Rodriguez, and I know she's on a schedule, so I'd like to, we asked them, her to come, a representative of Nassau County's commission, to let us know what their experience has been in the enforcement of their human, their source of income law. So, Ms. Rodriguez, could you join us up here, please? No, there's a seat right at the top of head of the table. And we are joined by Legislator Ryan. Yes, please. Thank you.
Good afternoon.
Hi. Thank you. Do you have a prepared statement that you'd like to tell us about?
More or less, I would memorize.
Okay.
My name is Margalie Rodriguez. I am with the Nassau County Commission on Human Rights. I've been with the Nassau County Commission on Human Rights for over 15 years now, and I am the supervisor of the Investigation and Compliance Unit. Our law was amended back in 2006, and it became effective in January 2007, which included source of income. It was as a result of several complaints that we were getting from our Nassau County residents. Now, Nassau County Commission on Human Rights only has jurisdiction over Nassau County, not Suffolk County. Now, we were getting a lot of phone calls, almost on a daily basis. I would say we were getting at least 15 calls from people who were qualified for housing, but for the fact that they were recipients of Section 8 and other housing assistance programs. So as a result, the Nassau County Board of Legislatives saw the need to amend the law, and it has worked. Number one, the calls have gone down a little bit, but it hasn't diminished. It has gone down a little bit. Right now we have about, let's say, 20 active cases that we are investigating. Now, on a daily basis, we receive about 10 calls from people. A lot of them are cases that we have been able to conciliate just by a telephone call. A lot of landlords and homeowners, they're really not aware of the law. They felt that they could, an applicant said, okay, I'm not working, but I do receive Section 8 or other housing assistance. Other housing assistance. The second they say that, the landlord said, oh, you know what, we'll call you. You never do. Or they'll say, you know what, we have several other people that we have to show the place to, but the people know why they've been denied. And when we do make a phone call and we speak with the homeowner or we speak with the landlord, they more or less have changed their mind. So this is how we've been able to conciliate a lot of cases. Now, the cases that we haven't been conciliated are cases where the people, the landlord is, they say, you know what, I do not want to participate in Section 8. You can force them. But there are other things other than source of income. That's the reason why those cases are really active in our cases. We in Nassau County have found that the law was very much needed, because now we have a lot of people who were not able to get into an apartment or get into a housing. Now they are getting into housing. We have a lot of people where they, although they had bad credit histories, but they would have been able to get into the housing. But for the law, they would not have been able to get into the housing. So therefore, we are very happy with the way the law is working and what we have accomplished, because our cases are being conciliated with a phone call. Once we explain to the landlord or to the homeowners what the law says and how it applies, it usually, you know, these cases do get conciliated.
How many cases, can you give us an idea of how many cases, if any, actually proceeded to a finding of discrimination where there was an adversarial proceeding as opposed to a conciliation? Do you have many of those? Or?
About, right now, since the law was passed, I would say about six.
And that's okay.
And when was the law passed again?
2006, but it became effective in 2007.
So that's six cases that have gone to actually a finding of discrimination?
Both probable cause or no probable cause.
Or no probable cause. Yes. So only six have gone beyond the conciliation stage. Where you haven't been able to conciliate it, so you had to reach a decision. Either there's probable cause or no probable cause.
Okay, let's say 15. But of those 15, I think we've issued about five determinations, but then once the determination has been issued, the cases have gotten conciliated. There were two where we believed they were going to go before the ALJ, but it didn't go that far. It did get conciliated.
So everything's been conciliated?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
So you've had none that have actually gone to a trial or a hearing?
No.
Or finding?
Well, by hearing, we do hold hearing in our
office. You hold the hearings in your commission office.
Exactly.
For probable cause finding.
Exactly.
But after that, has any gone beyond that to a hearing before an ALJ?
No, they're going to conciliate it.
I noticed that your source of income definition in your law says source of income means any lawful source of income, including federal, state, local, not-for-profit assistance, or subsidy programs. Have you had any cases where people have claimed that they are being discriminated against because they received child support or alimony or some other sort of income that's not from a state or federal government?
Actually, we have three. We have three, and they are very interesting cases. These people, they qualified for the housing, and we're hoping that they will be conciliated, because I have been on the telephone with the homeowner, and looks like it might lean towards conciliation, but we have three of those cases right now.
Would people have for child support or what, alimony or?
They have, I know that the mother is receiving, and the two of the mothers are receiving both, child support and alimony. Mm. The other one is only receiving child support.
And the landlord wouldn't rent to them because they were getting that source of, source of income was alimony or child support. They weren't Section 8 holders or?
No. What happened was, the landlord had claimed that the credit history of the applicants were bad.
Right.
But what they did was, they only ran one credit report on the applicant. And that one did not look too good. But when the applicant went to, I guess, a realtor, and they went from three separate sources, and two of them looked good. So, but now, because of that, because I was able to give to the landlord a copy of the other credit reports, so I have a feeling those cases will get conciliated also.
Well, what's your commission's view of if a landlord says, okay, they're getting, someone has a Section 8 voucher, but I don't like their credit history?
Because business decision is what we
can they about. Can a landlord, in your view, under your law, say, you know, it's not because the person has a Section 8 voucher, but because their credit history is not very good?
Well, we can force them to accept. I mean, once a person has been disqualified based on bad credit report, we cannot force the landlord to accept it. And we've explained that to the applicants. We told them, we represent the law. We don't represent you. We don't represent the respondent, meaning the landlord. We represent the law. If you are being disqualified based on your credit history, it is a business decision, so therefore the law really cannot protect you.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions from the legislators?
Thank you for coming, President. How many Section 8 offices are there in Nassau that administer the Section 8 program? Are you aware? Do you know?
I don't know from right off the bat, but I am aware of at least three. I'm aware of at least three, but I'm not 100% sure this is okay. All we have.
Just to follow up on the large communities have Section 8, Hempstead itself, and then other mm-hmm. communities, or are they just go to a county Section 8?
Oh, the whole county.
In other words, we have local communities that handle Section 8 mm-hmm. within their communities. Mm-hmm. And we're just trying to find out, you know, we have lots of communities that do
the three offices, are they all run by the county?
By the county.
Okay, so it's
So the county administers all the Section 8.
That's what I wanted. No, I appreciate that. That's one of the major issues
exactly.
here.
But I'm sure there are local CBOs that may run them.
Yeah, they do.
We have 12 or 13, and they're all sort of run.
I'm sure Nassau County probably have a lot more because of the area.
Yeah, that's right.
And I know, ETPA applies to Nassau, but mm-hmm. I don't know, but because the town, so we have a lot of towns and villages, and they all can implement ETPA, six units, eight units, 10 units. I don't know what happens in Nassau.
I'm sure we probably have a lot more than 10 in Nassau.
Well, it depends on which ones opted in.
Right.
Exactly.
Well, I mean, what I've heard from New York City, you've had more experience. New York City's law came after yours. What I heard from some enforcement people down there was just very difficult. You've touched on the fact that bad credit, but it sounds like one landlord came in, what seemed like bad credit, it didn't stop that. You found a realtor, two more credit reports, now you're debating which credit report. The report back to me was just very difficult to enforce when you're into that area, and it's still relatively new to them. And it was just because it's almost like, well, you can start. He said, she said, you had one credit report, but you obviously kept going.
Well, the reason why we kept going is because the applicant insisted that my credit is not as bad as they're claiming, and because of her persistence, we were for, and I said, well, give us a proof.
But how did you get into the criteria? Because a credit report is just numbers. I mean, it's just a number. Who's to decide at which number the landlord is prepared to say this is good or not good? It's not necessarily, the credit reports don't say good and bad. They give a number, right? There's a number there.
Exactly.
And how does your office decide? Do you get in and say to a landlord, well, we think this number is good enough? How do you square that with the landlord's own history of what they do? How do you get into that?
Well, what we did was we had asked the landlord, thank God the landlord had an attorney. Mm-hmm. So we had asked the landlords to show us the list of what they've used in the past to determine whether or not they would accept an applicant. And when we looked at it, we saw that there were applicants within the same category as our complainant.
Okay.
So therefore, we were able to convince the attorney for the response.
Okay, if I follow, that's good. But that landlord had an attorney, obviously had records. Your law seems to cover units four or more units.
Yes, yes.
Ours, I think, was a little hard, but four more. So you have a lot of four-family homes and landlords. They don't all necessarily have an attorney, which they have to pay for, and records. So, all right, I mean, it just...
Ours exempts four.
Their starts at four. Their starts at four. But in that particular case, this landlord had to hire an attorney and had the records. It may have been a big landlord. I don't know.
Exactly. It is.
Yeah. I mean, we have a lot of small landlords in Westchester. Some of our concerns are, to get into that situation, to come before you, they had to hire a lawyer. That adds to the cost. All right.
We're not required to.
But as you said, they're lucky. But again, the record was easy there because they had a lawyer, had the records. The concerns I'm hearing is when that doesn't exist, at some point, your office, not someone else's office, has to decide what is that judgment, business judgment.
We usually it's part of the investigation process. We ask them to give us a list of what, I mean, in the past, if you have denied other people based on their credit history, give us a list. And usually they just, blacken out the names and all that, and we look, and lo and behold, there were several people who they had accepted with lower, but not based on just one credit report, but they had, that company had at least three different from three different sources. But that landlord specifically chose to make its decision based on the lowest one.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate it.
Anyone else?
No.
If anyone from who's attending would like to ask any questions?
Co-ops and condos.
We'll get to that. Are they included in your law?
Yeah.
Do you include co-ops?
Do you include co-ops and condos?
Yes.
You do.
without specifically, I just couldn't find it when I read your law.
Well, it's not, if it's not accepted, it's then not it's included.
If it's not accepted, then it's included.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes, sir.
We exclude it.
As far as no income would apply to SSD, SSI, and DSS payments?
Yes. We're very liberal when it comes to social media. And in fact, obviously, three of those active cases that I mentioned, the complainants have is receiving federal disability payment. And it actually, those are one of the strongest cases. And the reason why the landlords are telling us, well, what if the person no longer becomes disabled? And we're like, wait a minute, it's the same thing when the person is employed. What if the person is terminated from his or her employment? So if you're basing it on that, it's kind of weak. So this is why we've been able to conceal it in a lot of those cases.
Yeah, there's some other questions?
John, you said that the Nassau County covers four family units?
Yeah, four or more units.
All right. Now, I see here in the materials here an unnamed source of income memoranda vis-a-vis ETPA, and down at the bottom it says, I originally, overview of New York City laws, I originally thought whatever, there's no attribution. Okay. And then down at the bottom, by contrast, Nassau County source of income applies to two family homes, unless the owner occupies one of those units. So I'm just curious what the story was.
We have a law in front of us, sir.
Yeah.
I think it's a mistake.
All right. Okay. Also, very quickly, I heard the young lady, I'm sorry, I came in the...
What is she referring to?
You said that at one point, I guess it was a complaint, the tenant already knows why they've been rejected?
Yes, they more or less have an idea once they've been rejected, because if based on our experience, a lot of them, they knew, they fill out the forms, they put down all their references, and the second they say, okay, we do have, you know, voucher, the landlord kind of turn off like that. So they more or less have an idea of why they were rejected. But then we don't make any determination based on their ideas. We do conduct an investigation to see if maybe there were other factors why they were terminated.
And when I originally heard that, I said, well, it seems to be a done deal because...
Oh, no.
It's just one of you first. It's okay. Either one. You'll both get a chance.
I had a question. What is the maximum penalty that can be assessed by your commission in this case, in this kind of a case?
Yeah, I see the penalty.
Ooh. The reason why I said "ooh" is because this is up for discussion now with the county attorney's office.
What's in the law now?
I didn't see anything in the last few years.
Not more than $100,000.
Yeah.
Even that we have.
In the Nassau law.
Nassau law, yeah.
What's your
name? It's 260.
Attorney's fees.
Yeah.
It's 2 what?
Because that
260.
We still have a big discussion in our office. And that's one of the things that I think the law gave
you. Civil penalty of not more than
$50,000.
An additional civil penalty of not more than $1,000 per day.
Wanted a malicious accident, $100,000.
Assessment against the landlord?
Have we had?
Yeah, had to, yeah.
No, not yet.
It happened. And how long have you been doing this?
Since 2000. The law became effective in 2007.
Okay. Almost 2 years.
One more question. Has there been any... Do you know whether the number of available Section 8 vouchers has changed from the time before to the time after the Human Rights Commission was approved? In other words...
I understand it's been increased.
Huh?
I understand it's been increased.
But the what?
It has been increased from what I understand.
The total number of vouchers, used.
Yes.
Has increased?
Yeah, there's been more
percentage
people.
Of the total, or are there just more vouchers available?
From what I am the one person, but I understand there's been more Section 8 recipients, more people applying for Section 8.
Oh, yeah, no, but I'm...
Are they getting
vouchers? Let me rephrase that. Have there been more... Has the number of Section 8 vouchers that people had and could not use them because landlords weren't accepting them, has that changed from before the law was passed to after the law was passed?
I couldn't tell you. I mean, we do have it.
Nobody studied that.
No. Well, I don't know if nobody studied it, but I'm not aware of anything, so I really don't want to give you the wrong answer.
Okay.
We do have an office, OHIA, they're the one administering Section 8 vouchers, they would be more knowledgeable of it.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Carl Finger from Finger Finger, the Building and Realty Institute, Council of the Building and Realty Institute. I had just two clarifications on something you said earlier. One was at the very beginning, and just might not have heard. You mentioned you were getting a certain number of calls relative to this problem prior to the legislation, the inception of legislation. Can you tell me what that number was again?
We were getting roughly, let's say, on a daily basis.
Whatever period you have the information.
Okay, I remember we were getting at least, per week, we were getting at least, let's say about 30 to 35 calls per week.
And that's about this particular problem?
Yes, oh yes.
Only on
social media. Oh yes, it was. And there were weeks where we were getting calls, like every time you pick up the phone, there were people saying, well, I went to look at an apartment, I thought I had the apartment, but the second I mentioned that I have Section 8, the landlord said, okay, we'll call you, or the realtor said, you know what, they're not going to accept it, so you might as well.
So it seemed to be a pervasive problem.
It was.
When I said seems, I didn't mean to cover it. The second thing, I thought you said that you cannot force participation in Section 8, but I might have misheard that.
You heard me correctly.
Could you expound upon that, please?
Okay, we still, we've gone through some discussion with the county attorney's office. At first, we were told that if a landlord or homeowner does not participate in the Section 8 programs, so therefore you really cannot force him to accept it. But I'm still not too clear with that. Because if the landlord is not participating, it means that he or she can say, okay, I'm not part of the Section 8 program, so therefore I don't have to accept it. Because we're not too clear on that, so our experience has been that once the landlord has refused to accept an applicant based on his or her source of income, say Section 8, we have been able to convince them that to accept the Section 8 program.
Okay, can I follow up on that?
Yeah.
So, is it my understanding then that the law as written, if a landlord doesn't accept any Section 8, the law can, it's not in essence a discrimination to say I'm not accepting any Section 8, but you've been successful nonetheless in conciliating things to more as a mediation to get these certain landlords where the complaints have come before you, those situations resolved.
Exactly.
But the interpretation of the legislation is that a landlord not accepting any Section 8 isn't discriminating against a particular individual by not taking Section 8 because they don't take Section 8 at all.
Exactly. I mean, this is what I mean, the same way you are confusing about it, we have been also. So we've been lucky enough, once we've intervened, most, if not all, respondents have been able to say, okay, you know what, okay, we'll accept it, provided the tenant has good credit history.
No, I understand that you've gotten a resolution. I'm just clarifying that the interpretation of the statute is that if the landlord's not taking any Section 8, that they're not required to, and they don't fall within a discriminatory, I guess, context.
Exactly.
Okay, thank you.
Do you have a legal opinion from your county attorney on that issue?
We don't have one, and we've been asking for one. And in fact, when I get back to my office, I'm going to talk and call them, because I know I've got that question quite often.
Has anyone challenged your law on the basis that it can't apply to a landlord who has never accepted Section 8?
No, not yet.
Because your law, when you read the law, would seem to cover a landlord who does not now accept Section 8.
It would seem that they have to accept it, whether or not they want to accept it, exactly. But then when we went to trainings, we were told that, okay, the landlord doesn't participate. Because from what I understand, for you to accept the Section 8, there are certain conditions you have to meet. So if the landlord cannot meet those conditions, so therefore we cannot force them to accept it.
If they don't satisfy the Section 8
criteria. If they
criteria.
Don't fix the windowsill.
Right.
And all that.
Exactly. And where was this training?
It was done with the OHIA, that's the office that administered the Section 8 program for one of the offices. that administer the Section 8 program for the Nassau County. And we've also been to a training with the Long Island Housing Services also.
Okay, can we have this gentleman and then Marty continues?
Just a quick question. You said co-ops and condos are covered, yes. Rentals. It also, does the law also cover purchases of co-ops and condos? And is it going before a co-op board and the purchase of a co-op? Does that law cover that?
I would think I don't know, because I don't know, to be honest with you. All I know is this, I'm sure if the person has gone before the board and his or her, you know, income checked out, I don't, to be honest, we haven't had that yet.
Okay.
Most of the landlords.
Yeah, no, it's just interesting on this point, because I think in our many, many hours of discussions, I think we, at one point, we sort of honed in on when I think, Jeffrey Levin, the fellow from the Human Rights Commission, was here, the amount of repairs. So we got to do, if it's $100 to make the repair, well, okay, if it's $15,000 to repair the apartment, then you know, might say, well, it's unreasonable to make the landlord make those repairs, and therefore maybe they don't come under your jurisdiction. So I don't know if it's a judgmental, but we sort of backed into that same kind of analysis. Does it apply? Does it, based on, can you be forced?
Exactly.
And on one hand, the law does... You know, it's discrimination. So one hand say yes, it's but for certain, you know, credit reports, you have to. Then the question came up: but suppose it's $10,000 worth of repairs.
Excessive for them to force.
And well, you might say it's excessive. Someone else might say the law says,
but this
you can't discriminate. And so, but we got into that.
Our draft had your law does not have a defense based upon the landlord exercising a reasonable business. Judgment, right?
No,
you don't have that.
That's
we have that.
So it's a question of judgment of how. We have $100,
that's
$500,
right.
$2,000.
That's right.
Any other questions for Ms. Margulis?
Thank you.
Thank you very much for
Thank
coming.
Thank you.
I appreciate your taking the time to come here.
Rainy day. I understand the rain's going to get worse.
Yes.
Oh, dear.
Before we get into some other follow-ups from the last meeting, generally, and some further discussion. I know Mr. Oros is a busy man. He's got a lot to do. Do you want to follow up with whether the administration has any position on this legislation? He's not leaving. He's coming. He's just coming in the other door.
It's easier than coming.
Right, it is. Thank you.
Actually, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Oros.
I have a meeting upstairs.
And we're going to let you go. I know
that involves your district.
I know.
Yeah, okay.
My legislative aide is there.
Oh, right? Man. Exactly.
That one.
My legislative aide is there.
Yes, I know. As you know, we submitted the implementation plan on Friday. We indicated in there what has been done and what is being done to promote the source of income legislation. And at this point, you know, we're just waiting to see if the feds and the monitor feel that's adequate for what we're doing. And if they sign off on this, then, you know, we've done our part.
Yeah. What is it? We don't have the implementation. I mean, is it on the, maybe it's on the website.
Yeah, it should be. It should
what
be.
Does it say about the
Well, specifically it talks about the steps that have been taken, the fact that Dorothy's been here a number of times, I mean, Dolores been here a number of times from the Human Rights Commission, and all the evidence and information that was presented to the Legislation Committee both last term and this term.
Do you think the HUD or the monitor expect that the committee, that the board actually vote on this one way or the other?
I don't know what the monitor expects, and I wouldn't want to speculate what the monitor. In fact, we, as you know, we sent a draft of our revisions to the monitor about a week before the deadline, hoping to get some feedback so that, you know, a final draft that we submitted might be something totally acceptable.
Yeah,
I haven't heard anything since Friday.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. George, I guess if I can pin you down a little more specifically, I guess John asked, does the administration have a pro or con view of this piece of legislation? I know you brought us up to date on where it is in the implementation.
I think our job is to promote the legislation, and we feel we've done that, and we put how we did that in the implementation plan we sent the monitor.
And what did you say about how you promoted the legislation?
Well, I think I told you that we had that the Human Rights Commission, Dorothy
Dolores.
Was here.
Dolores.
I'm sorry.
Dorothy Finger. Dolores Scottway.
Yes, was here We outlined, I don't have it specifically in front of me now, but there was a little more detail as to the meetings that were attended by her and the information that was given to the legislature.
Okay, so the focus of the promotion has been her efforts as a Human Rights Commission director. Any other questions for Mr. Oros?
Yeah, I haven't seen the changes in the new implementation plan that you submitted. And my question would be, was it requested of us to add this or to show this as part of our implementation?
Yes.
It specifically was in the monitor's letter.
Yes, it was one of the things that was commented upon.
So it was left out the first one?
Well, I don't know that it was left out. I just think, as with many things in that, the monitor and HUD felt we were a little vague in terms of, and so we tried to be more specific with some of these things, and that was one of those items.
Okay. So the administration's position is that it has promoted the legislation.
That's correct.
That we have pending legislation.
Right. And that the administration has therefore fulfilled its responsibility under the settlement agreement.
Okay. We'll soon find out.
Thanks a lot.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. We have some more follow-ups from the last meeting. One is, and we just received a memo from the county attorney's office tonight. Can I ask that Ms. Nicholas Brewster come up and since we've just gotten this, maybe you can take us through the memorandum. The issue was the ramifications of the interaction between the ETPA and the proposed source of income law.
Including the right. Do we have to be, I know it says privileged and confidential.
Yeah. On the top. And delivered privilege.
We asked for a legal opinion. I think we want to know what it is.
Just want to make sure. Okay.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay.
You're the lawyer.
We are waiving the privilege, I guess.
That's basically what I'm saying.
Good afternoon. Mary Lynn Nicholas Brewster from the County Attorney's Office. We were requested to research whether the proposed source of income anti-discrimination law would mandate continual participation by the landlord in the Section 8 Housing Choice Voucher Program. And our opinion is that it does not. Under Rosario, and Rosario was dealing with the New York State Rent Stabilization Code that is applicable to New York City and has similar provisions to the ETPA, which requires that renewal lease be on the same terms and conditions as the expired lease. And the New York State Court of Appeals held that if a landlord accepts a Section 8 tenant, that Section 8 program or the addendums to the lease would be a term and condition that had to be continued in a renewal lease. So our position is that our law simply is an anti-discrimination law, would prohibit discrimination based on source of income, which would include Section 8 subsidies and vouchers, and it is really the ETPA, the state statute, not our law, but the state statute that requires that renewal leases be on the same terms and conditions as an expired lease. So the Court of Appeals has already settled this issue. The Court of Appeals has essentially maintained that if a landlord accepts a Section 8 tenant in these types of programs, then that is a requirement that they continue with that same term and condition. So that is not a requirement that this board is imposing, but it's something that the New York State Court of Appeals has addressed in a similar statutory scheme and has found that that is consistent with federal law and it has been upheld by the New York State Court of Appeals.
So let me just follow up. So despite the fact that it's not under our law, the fact that we are enacting this law, because of the Court of Appeals decision, a landlord would be required to renew a Section 8 tenant's lease under Rosario.
Would be, regardless of our law. I mean, if an ETPA landlord accepts a Section 8 tenant currently without our law being even in place, under Rosario, that's required. Our law simply prohibits discrimination, but currently ETPA landlords under Rosario would be required to renew a lease under the same terms and conditions as a Section 8, with the Section 8 terms and conditions there. So our law doesn't have
an impact in that way, because currently the Rosario is interpreted to require that continued renewal of the lease under those terms and conditions.
Okay. Mr. Rogalski. Right.
Yes, thank you. I mean, it's a very important distinction you stated, because you asked a specific question, you answered the question specifically, but you said we would not be imposing. The fact of the matter is, we would be imposing it, not through this law, but we have to take, as a legislature, we take judicial notice, or whatever you call it, of laws out there and cases out there, knowing that the loss, the court case settles the law, for now at least, that landlords must renew to Section 8. By passing this law, we are imposing Section 8 because it's out there in the existing law. So my question beyond that is based on the answer here, because ETPA gets very confusing. If a family member is there for 2, 3, or 4 years within the definition, I under existing law, not our law, but under existing law, it would be interpreted that a family member of a Section 8 tenant, that if this law were to pass and the Section 8 tenant were that accepted by a landlord because of this law, that family member 4 years later under existing law would also have the right to stay there should that Section 8 tenant move or die or whatever, right? And I guess that gets to the point of credit reports, and I know it's existing law, but the concerns that people have where, for whatever business judgment, certain landlords today under existing law have chosen not to accept Section 8. Family members that come along, they may end up under ETPA rules and regulations having someone else in their apartment as the succeeding Section 8 member without, I imagine, additional credit checks or anything else. It's just,
wouldn't
just
that
there
person have to be have a Section 8 voucher?
Well, I don't know. It's a good question. I don't know. They're a family member under ETPA, but maybe they would be there without necessarily a Section 8 voucher.
Section 8.
That's a good question. That's a fair question.
Then it's not a source of income, man.
Well, they may or may not have a Section 8, but if in fact, that's a fair point. But let's say under the circumstances where they did have a Section 8 voucher,
the other person
would be able to stay there. But if they didn't have a Section 8, they'd have to first go, if they needed one. I mean, if they needed one to get there.
Is this only?
Before we go on, I just want to give Ms. Margulies a chance to correct something that we thought was our mistake, but apparently it wasn't. Go ahead.
Yeah, earlier I had said 4 or more. Our local office is 4 or more, but it's 2 or more.
Right. So
it is 2 or more. That's something.
Right. More.
Was this law?
So if you have a two-family house,
you don't have the updated law.
Part of the program. Part of the law.
If the owner resides in the housing, it doesn't call it. It doesn't make it 2 or more. It's just my
opinion. Okay, so then if it's a single house and the landlord, for instance, owns it but lives someplace else?
If it is determined as 2 or more in it, then the law would cover it.
Regardless of whether he resides in the house.
I just wanted to just follow up, and there was a question asked about the succession rights, and we did review what the succession rights were under the ETPA. And then finally, the last question was whether New York City's source of income's anti-discrimination law applies to only existing tenants, because there's some language there regarding it applying to tenants who are subject to rent control who resided in the housing accommodation at the time that the law was enacted. But from our research, the cases and the New York City Commission on Human Rights has interpreted the New York City law to apply to not only existing tenants, but to new tenants as well. So that's it. It's been, even though it's worded in one way, the courts and New York City's Commission on Human Rights has said it applies to new tenants as well as existing tenants.
I need a little. May I ask you a question?
Sure, of course.
ETPA, from what I understand, an example, I was on the town board when we passed the ETPA law, which covers apartments that people were residing in that were specifically identified as an apartment, and the rates were set,
right.
And it was very difficult for landlords to increase the rates.
Right.
And some people that are still living in paying ridiculous rents, right. But family members could go. How does the ETPA come in under the source of income separate from, you know, you keep mentioning ETPA, but if I live in an apartment and I'm getting Section 8, that's not an ETPA-identified apartment, it doesn't matter.
Well,
my
right.
son living with me can't go on in that apartment without Section 8 or with it.
No, the issue is here, if you have an apartment that is subject to ETPA,
yes.
And a tenant that has Section 8. Mm-hmm. What effect does that have on the, if it's not an ETPA apartment, when the Section 8 lease expires, the landlord doesn't have to renew it. But under ETPA, he's required to renew it, or
yes.
She's required to.
Regardless of whether there's Section 8 or not.
Right.
Am I correct, that gentleman, in the business field?
Well,
the question is, if I live in an ETPA recognized apartment on Main Street, and I die and my son's living with me, my son has the right to continue that apartment at the established rate under ETPA law right now. It has nothing to do with source of income.
There are succession rights.
Yes.
Succession
rights.
Yeah. Yeah. Has nothing to do with source of income.
Well, it would, for example.
I need to know that because
okay.
This is confusing to me.
Right. If there's someone who, for instance, is in an apartment and
yeah.
they've been there for a long time,
yeah.
say the first, the parent dies, the child succeeds to the apartment before the parent didn't have Section 8. The child decides to get Section 8 or qualify for Section 8.
Mm-hmm.
Then under this law, source of income law, the landlord would be obligated to accept Section 8 for that child that has succeeded to the apartment.
They would have to accept them regardless of Section 8?
Well, he'd be required to go into the Section 8 program, whereas before he wasn't in the Section 8 program.
Well, no, he'd be in the Section 8 program.
Mr. Chuck, that's very, let me follow the example. That's a good point.
Because
I go through them. If someone is not, someone has a tenant who's not Section 8.
Right.
Not
right.
Section 8.
ETPA.
Right.
Daughter moves in, to pick on the daughter. Daughter moves in, and 5 years later, the tenant leaves. Now, the daughter, under ETPA, the daughter succeeds.
Has the right of succession.
Now, the daughter loses the job, but the daughter goes to apply for Section 8. And let's just say, you draw several different scenarios. Let's say that this particular case, the daughter has a terrible credit history. Was living off the parent, terrible credit history. Daughter's in the apartment. So whereas ordinarily the landlord might say, you know what, check the credit history. The law says I can't discriminate, because the law's on the books now. Can't discriminate. You have a terrible credit history. I don't want to take you. The additional problem is the daughter's in the apartment. And so now it just adds a very practical problem. Landlord says, under the law, I don't have to take you to Section 8 because you don't qualify under my standard Section 8, but you're in the apartment. So it just raises an interesting question to a judge. What do you do there? They're already in the apartment, not paying the rent because they got the Section 8 voucher, and the question is going to be, you know, that voucher's going for the rent, the landlord doesn't want to take the rent because doesn't want the Section 8. Anyway, it's a consequence of this law. It's an example that would come up.
I just wanted to respond because the ETPA, I mean, was enacted initially to protect tenants because, you know, of a lack of housing and all of that in the 1970s. But within the actual regs, it provides reasons for evicting tenants, one being non-payment of rent. So even under the ETPA, a landlord is not required.
No, but this tenant will be coming in, applying for, has a Section 8 voucher, it will go into court and say, here's my Section 8 voucher. Under our law, trying to get the landlord to accept the voucher, and the landlord's in court saying, you don't qualify from credit history, I don't want you. And now you're just fighting over that issue. But the tenant is already in the apartment. I mean, it's just an interesting example.
Any other comments on this topic, Ms. Tenema?
One of the reasons that a lot of the tenant advocates hoped for this bill is because we were seeing a lot of elderly tenants in ETP regulated apartments paying 60, 70, 80% of their income, gross or net, towards rent, struggling with it, but paying, because obviously they're still in the apartment, they haven't been evicted for non-payment. All of a sudden, they come to the top of the list, they get a Section 8 voucher, and they now have the chance, if the landlord will take the voucher, to start paying 30% of their income towards rent and spend the rest of it on medical care, food, or whatever else they need. and the landlord will turn the voucher away, we think in part because they want to free up the apartment to raise the rent. So I'm sure it happens sometimes that a person who has succeeded to the apartment gets a voucher and the landlord won't take it, but that's not the majority of cases. The vast majority of cases are elderly people living alone on a fixed income, paying vast proportions of their income towards rent. That's the problem.
I mean, the question about the person who succeeds with a bad credit history, they still have to be able to pay their share of the rent.
Mm-hmm. Well, they might, but they've applied for Section 8. They may be unemployed. Section 8 paid the whole thing.
John, so then the credit history doesn't matter.
Well,
yes. And the thing is that I'm finding, in my own experience, an increasing number of issues with succession are occurring. It used to be that wasn't such a big issue, but increasingly it is. If they have, you know, people who've been there for a long time, have a great deal. The law gives them a great deal. And then on top of that, you have to deal with the Section 8 issues and requirements and everything else. And so, you know, you can bring up the, you know, issue of, you know, retired people on fixed incomes and whatnot, and that nobody here is against, you know, those kinds of issues. Our biggest concern has to do with succession, and it's increasingly an issue where you have young people that come in and then they succeed to the apartment and you get here for a whole different generation. The issue that I think, one of the issues, has to do in the preamble to the existing law, there are all kinds of examples about things all around the country. And one of the points we're trying to make is that although this law does not specifically mention Section 8, because this law this doesn't specifically mention ETPA requirements, but because this law combined with ETPA requirements means that all these examples about what's happening in the rest of the country don't apply here, because this proposed law in combination with ETPA provides an onerous requirement on the landlords, in addition to the whole other structure about documentation requirements and everything else, which I can go into in detail. But that's, I just want to confirm that things in the preamble of this law don't, from other states, don't apply.
But Nassau and New York City would, because they have,
yeah,
they have
right,
the equipment.
Right, but a lot of things have to do with, you know, Oregon and some other place that, you know, are totally inappropriate.
Any other questions? Any other questions for
Carol?
Yeah.
No.
She was looking at you.
Okay. Discuss these.
Mary Lynn, thank you. I don't think anybody has any other questions for you.
Thanks.
I also, at the last meeting, asked if anybody. What?
I think it's great.
We're going to get to that in a second. Before we move on to some issues I'd like to raise, the other question we asked at the last meeting was, any of the realtors or housing advocates have any comments regarding the definition of source of income? And we provided with the packet today a comparison of the definitions in the various other jurisdictions which have enacted source of income legislation. As you can see, some of them are very broad. Like the one with Nassau says source of income means any lawful source of income, which to me my personal view is that's overbroad. I think we're trying to address some specific issues here which have to do with people on some sort of state, local, or not-for-profit assistance. But the Nassau definition is very broad. When you look at New York City, that's more limited. That deals with federal, state, or local public assistance or Social Security. Whereas you look at the city of Hamburg in New York State, any income or source of rent payment from lawful sources, which could mean, you know, just the fact you have a job. And I don't think that's...
Or alimony or trust.
It can include all of that, too. Now, that's
lottery winning.
So the question that we have is, and we'd like to hear from legislators may have questions too, is whether, since the purpose of this law is to deal with people receiving some sort of assistance for their rent from a government agency or a not-for-profit, whether the definition in our law should be restricted to those. We now say source of income means lawful verifiable income derived from Social Security or any form of federal, state, or local public assistance or housing assistance, grant or loan program, including the federal housing subsidy known as Section 8, disability payments. And then we have court-ordered payments, assistance, grant, or loan program from a private housing assistance organization, annuities, pensions, and child and spousal support. So the question I have is, for everybody out there, is do we need to, why do we need to include annuities, pensions, and child or spousal support if the focus of this law is to deal with people who are receiving government assistance or assistance from a not-for-profit? Anybody want to comment on that? Some of the laws, if you look at this comparison, some of the laws are more restrictive and some of them are broader. And so we have a choice of, you know, how broadly we want to define source of income.
Are you asking whether or not we should expand what's in the draft legislation?
No, whether we should retract.
Yes. On that, but you raise a good point. I think I asked this before, but it seems to me, because I'm aware of some, but maybe not all, and it may go to ultimately maybe trying to find a compromise if that's possible.
So
in that spirit, right, the broad, there should be a way to get from either the planning department or DHCR, the state, somewhere, what are in fact the state and federal subsidy programs? Because I'm aware of one that I've had, you know, experience with that I might be willing to support. You have an existing tenant, and they lose their job, they get sick, and they come in with that emergency shelter verification form that they need a rollover, a month to 2 months from DSS to give. I mean, I might be willing to support this. To me, a landlord should sign that. So to me, that's a form of public assistance that at least I might be able to support.
But
I might not be able to support with Section 8, but I might be. So the question, if we could define, I mean, there's got to be a list somewhere. Instead of just saying, as you say, all public assistance programs. Well, what exactly does that mean? And if we could get a list of them, just speaking for myself in the spirit of trying to find a compromise, there might be one or more public assistance programs that you know, make sense to me, and I might be willing to support including those and some don't. So I just say if we can get a definition, to your point about it, just said broadly.
Well, my concern is not so much public assistance programs.
Well, yeah, I know, annuities and all that.
Other sources.
But within public assistance, can't we get a list somewhere of what they are?
Legislator Harkin and then Legislator Burton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Annuities and pensions, as you raised, seem to me more to fall in the spirit of amount of income versus source
level
of income.
Yeah, which the
and we have said that this legislation is not amount. It's not about protecting amount of income. It's about protecting source of income. I think the record shows that I'm a strong proponent of this law. I would not have a problem taking out annuities and pensions because I believe that gets to amount of income versus source of income.
I'm concerned about Legislator Rogowski's effectively substituting certain public programs for Section 8.
Well, they're out there.
Am I reading this right? The what I'm hearing is you're saying you would accept A and B, but you would not accept Section 8. Is that what you're trying to say? So you're looking for programs that we could agree on, but the one that you would not agree on is Section 8.
Right. Because philosophically, I got all kinds of problems with just imposing Section 8. But I see, I've experienced other public assistance programs, mm-hmm. especially with existing tenants. So the whole business judgment of a landlord picking the tenant. Landlord's going through all that. And it's 5 years after they pick that tenant, they're paying the rent. They get sick. They lose their job. Something happens. They go run into DSS. They're going to get a job in 3 months. They need I'm not sure I understand the whole program, but the point is they need a short carryover. And the landlord might say, a chance to get that tenant out, boom, boom. But other landlords, I would say all landlords, give that tenant a chance to get back on their feet. Sign the damn verification form. Tell them that this is their rent. Go to DSS, get 1 or 2 months rent, and you're back on your feet. I might be willing to support something like that because philosophically, that works for me. Imposing a Section 8, we heard in Nassau County, at least it's run by the county. We've been through this before. We have 13 offices all run differently, different rules. So I have a lot of problems with that. But imposing a public assistance program where it's short term, it fits different criteria, I might be willing to support that. So in the spirit of compromise, yeah. But we should see the list, because we're agreeing to something as it is now. We don't even know all those. We know Section 8. I mean, can you list the 1, 2, 3, or 6 programs that we're even putting into the bill? We don't even know what they are.
Well, I thought it was the other way around. I thought one of the things we were being specific about is including Section 8.
Well, that's one program.
Right. But
there are others.
We are not referencing the others.
Oh, no, they're all included.
Right. Well,
and I'm just saying like, what they are.
That's what the legislation says now?
Yes, it's all public assistance programs, right? That's how I read it.
Any form of federal, state, or local.
I'm just asking, what are they? I'm not for or against them. I'm just trying to find out what they are. Why can't we at least know what they are?
You want to scratch out Section 8, but you're willing to take A, C, and...
Well, man, I'm willing to talk about it. My first question is we should know what they are. Just know what they are. I can tell you one. This is emergency shelter verification. That's one program. There may be no others. There may be 5 others. I'm saying we should, before we pass a law that covers everything, we should say more than everything. We should say what is, at least having the record, but to put it in the law, but no one should know what we're talking about. What federal programs, state programs are we talking about? I don't think it's too much to ask. The advocates may know, someone may know what they are. We list them real pretty quickly.
Anybody want to answer that?
Well, I would say to begin with that they vary. I mean, they add a new program. How can you...
No, I want to list them. We don't need to list them in the law.
So you have to say, I mean, all existing programs and programs that come into being?
Well, our law just says now all.
Because
so.
You can't change the law every time a new
The law doesn't have to list them. The law could just say all.
Yeah.
But around this table, we should just know, in the record, we should know what we're talking about. That's all.
You want a list of every program that might offer a grant? I mean...
Well, we're passing a law to include them. So I think it's fair to everybody out there.
May I comment on this point, Mr. Chairman?
On that point, you may.
I think the concern
that I have...
Thank you
for joining us. You're only about 45 minutes late, but that's normal.
I had other stuff going on. I thought it would be better to catch the tail end of it.
No,
than
we appreciate your presence. Your comments are always valuable.
The concern that I have with respect to these programs is what comes along with the money. And that's the requirement for an annual filing, it's the requirement for inspections, et cetera. And I think that's the concern I would have with a blanket all programs. It seems to me that if you have a program that just gives money and makes sure the tenant is there, that's fine. But when you're starting to get into a program where all of a sudden you're enlisting the landlord into a program, filling out forms and doing all kinds of things, that's a little different. That's more than they bargained for. And they should have the option of saying yes or no to that program. As I've said, as an attorney, I've represented people who do Section 8, and they love it. They don't have a problem with it. But they know what they're getting into, and they're willing to do it. Other people are just saying, I don't want the paperwork, and I just don't want to deal with it. And so you want to come to me with cash or checks, I'll take you as a tenant. But I don't want to have your Section 8. You know, you want to work out some other way of getting the money, fine. And I think that's a stumbling block to me with respect to this law. I agree with Mr. Rogowski.
Yeah,
I think
people, is that we're imposing a requirement on a landlord?
That the requirement that they that will entail filling out paperwork and all that kind of stuff.
Did you vote for the no pet clause legislation, where we told landlords they can't exclude pets?
I don't recall.
I mean, that infringes on a landlord's right to protect their apartments from, you know, pets.
I don't recall whether. I don't remember.
It's one of the laws we're looking at.
3 months.
The no pet clause.
It's a 3 month.
I don't know if that's...
At least have 3 months to get them out.
Right.
No, that...
It's a three. It's 90 days.
90 days. Open and...
Get them out or eat them.
Right. I think there was an agreement on that. It wasn't a, you know... But what I'm saying here is... I think the issue that Mr. Rogowski is raising, when you say all programs, somebody comes along with another program that has even more severe restrictions in Section 8, and we've said you've got to take the program.
Is there anybody here who can identify the programs we're all questioning and concerning?
That's what. Yes, I mean,
certainly that are.
Can anybody give us a list
before we
we'll get that. We'll put that in the committee report
before we impose them. We should know what they are.
What are we talking
about? Plan? I mean, Section 8.
Oh, there's others.
Emergency tenant assistance.
Well, I think Norma is here. Is Norma here?
Norma was here.
Norma was.
She left. She's upstairs in the meeting. Excuse me.
A lot of the programs that are here have emergency housing grants. I can get Barbara if you want. She can probably off the top of her head.
Let's see if she can give us some information.
Well, it's not going to be complete. Marty and Tom are asking.
No, we'll get it from planning. We'll get it from planning and social services. the other issue I had was child and spousal support. This, my concern is, again, trying to take into account the legitimate concerns of the landlord. You know, Section 8 is Section 8, and if a tenant ceases to qualify for Section 8 or violates the Section 8 requirements, presumably they can be evicted or their lease doesn't have to be renewed or something. But if a husband, an ex-husband, stops paying child or spousal support, I mean, what's the landlord supposed to do if they're not getting the funds?
Does the landlord have the right to interview the husband or the wife who's paying the child support or the spousal support?
Not that I know. Where's that?
Man, is prohibit that?
Deep right
in other words, today, if someone were to come in and a landlord were to say, where's your income?
Right.
And they said, well, my husband, I would think at that point the landlord would be within his or her right to ask the husband or the spouse.
That would be terrific. Let's see the court
order. Court order that right. Or the separation agreement or the divorce decree or whatever grants the spousal support. But that's fine, but that doesn't mean the husband's going to continue to pay.
Correct.
Or the wife's going to continue to
pay. Or the person's going to continue to hold his job.
Does this prohibit that? Does this prohibit the landlord saying?
No, but it doesn't protect the landlord if the landlord interviews the husband or the wife and says, yeah, I'm going to continue to pay spousal support. Yeah, here's the decree, and then they disappear. That doesn't protect the landlord after the fact. That's why I think, I'm not sure I think we should protect as much as you'd like to, but because it puts an unfair burden on the landlord if the spouse walks away from the obligation.
Right, but that's why I was asking, would this prohibit the landlord? If you were to leave the language in, and I tend to agree with you that it should not be in, but if you were to leave the language in, would this prohibit the landlord from interviewing the spouse and making a judgment on the spouse's ability
to... The spouse was willing to be interviewed, but what makes...
But if not, then can you say, well, look, I'm not going to take you?
What if the spouse produces a divorce decree or a court order that says, here's the obligation to pay?
So?
That's even better than the interview, because that's a court-ordered payment.
But if it's court-ordered payment that the person can't make, then you've got a piece of paper that's worth nothing.
Tom, what's the difference between that and the person losing his job?
Exactly.
No. Anyway.
That's wildly inappropriate. I'm sorry to be judgmental, but...
I don't know if I were... I'm not a landlord, but if I were, I would want to interview the spouse who's paying the money to make sure that spouse can afford to pay it.
That doesn't mean you're not going to...
What if the spouse loses his job? What if it's a domestic violence? Or a domestic violence case.
Well, that's a different issue. That's a separate basis.
Right,
there we are.
Mr. Chairman, just one more... Just a general comment. I mean, you know, living under the ETPA, as was pointed out, we're probably the only area of the country that has these laws on top of potential Section 8.
I mean, New York State.
New York State. But one of the practical problems, again, that landlords run into today, it's just a fact of life. We probably can't change it. But certainly local judges, in my opinion, in my experience, are the system doesn't work efficiently. I mean, if a landlord could go into court, 3 days' notice, 5 minutes, or here's a petition, right. Boom, and, you know, you're out.
2 months.
The system, and that's on paper. We talk about on paper. That's how the system is. Judges go months and months.
Yep.
And all, so,
even
but,
in Harrison.
But that's what it is. Even in Harrison. But that is what it is. All I'm saying is, if in fact we put this law on top of it, in addition to the existing problem, now you have source of income coming in or Section 8 comes in. It's just so someone goes in and then it's just the system is so inefficient that, you know, again, maybe we could work to fix that. But the judges do what they want to do, given the lack of housing, judges being compassionate and saying, well, before I evict you, you know, I want to wait till you find some place to go. And it goes months and months, but who gets the hit on the rent? It's the landlords. While the judge is trying to do what we all try to do, get more housing, help people out, and it's the landlord that sits there subsidizing the rent for those months. It's just a general comment.
The process for evicting a Section 8 tenant is exactly the same.
I know, it's the same as today. It's the same as today.
Faster, slow as evicting someone.
I agree. It's just one other thing. I agree. It's the existing system.
That's not entirely so, because you have to give... additional notice to Section 8. And it may be a small requirement, but I think it's a layer of requirement where the entire objection to this type of legislation by the apartment ownership or landlord community, is the idea that there are all these extra little layers, and maybe a little layer in the eviction, maybe another little layer in the rent increase where the landlord can't get, yes, he has another DTPA, but no, it didn't get to Section 8. They didn't approve it in time, and he lost the increase for that couple of months or whatever. So I don't entirely agree. I'm not saying the whole process is different, but I think each of these incremental little steps adds, you know, a burden to the landlord in terms of time constraints, financial constraints, and with a statute like this, liability constraints.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to second what Mr. Rogowski said about the problem with the court system. Usually I'm on the side of the tenants representing them, but there have been a few times where I've represented landlords, and I have one recently where a person bought a two-family house. The tenants did not vacate. They were given notice in time. They were supposed to be out by the end of January. They weren't. We were in court like on the 3rd, 4th, 5th of February. The judge gave them till the end of March to move out. And this was a two-family house with a tenant, with a purchaser of the building, was a tenant somewhere else and had already given notice and was supposed to move into this apartment for himself with it and his kids. And the judge basically just said, give him time to find a place. And the lady and her husband said, well, we haven't liked any of the apartments we've seen. We need more time. Okay.
Well, that's going to happen whether there's Section 8
or not.
Well, the point
is, exactly, but just the fact is, if the judges do that with a non-governmental program, in a circumstance like this where a person buys a building is going to move in, what happens when you're dealing with a large building and you're dealing with a governmental program? I mean, it's the government.
Person stops paying their share. Section 8 pays their share. Person stops paying their
share. Person should be evicted.
But it takes 2 months, 3 months.
It takes months.
I know, but it happens.
In any case. This is just that.
This law does not have any further impact on that.
It just adds to it. I'm saying it's the existing.
No, it doesn't add to it. It stays exactly the same.
You're
requiring the landlord to take the tenant. The landlord could look and say, you know, we're fortunate in our circumstance. We know these people have resources. So if they overstay, we can go after them and collect the rent. We can sue them and get a judgment against them. But if you have a Section 8 tenant who doesn't have any resources other than the Section 8, and now they're not paying their section of it, and they get an extra 2 months, the landlord is out that money and can't recover it. Section 8 doesn't make you whole.
Section 8 doesn't make you whole.
But there are tons of people. You got to accept
that. But if anybody else...
They might have other assets.
Yeah, but they may not, too. You're making judgments.
But we're passing a law imposing this.
But we're not imposing anything that's not happening in the free market right now.
No, yes, they're choosing not to take Section 8. They're choosing not to take Section 8. They're not enough assets.
Okay.
They're not taking Section 8.
It's income, not assets.
I just wanted to give a real life... example about the difference between the tenant rent and the subsidy, because that actually is an actual real problem where what happens is, just for context, the tenant may not be paying their amount, and let's say it's $100 a month out of, you know, $1,000 rent or whatever. So the landlord is in a position where either they have to hire a lawyer, go out to the tenant for their portion, $100, which doesn't really make sense, or wait some period of time. 7 months go by, and still now that amount builds up, plus late fees, et cetera. So suddenly the landlord's looking at, they wait 6 months, they serve a 3-day demand, the tenant says, okay, I'm going to pay you next week, or whatever, it doesn't happen. The next thing you know, it's 7 or 8 months. Now it's like $800, $900. The landlord goes to court, finally, because now the amount actually is, fairly, for a small landlord, a fairly substantial amount. A couple of months into the proceeding, legal services comes in and makes a motion to dismiss. I know they never do that, but it could happen. But one of the bases for the motions to dismiss frequently that we face is of what's called a latches argument, saying you waited too long, mm-hmm. and therefore your rent is stale. And so it is a dilemma, and it is a problem that occurs where with Section 8 that doesn't occur outside the Section 8 context, because the tenants in outside the Section 8 context, generally speaking, responsible for the full amount of the rent. So you don't have this disparity. I mean, you may have a tenant short in a given month, but you don't have a certain disparity each month. So, and I've seen this happen, you know, I wouldn't say it happens all the time, but it definitely happens. So to some extent, how much time to wait, I think it's a real-life situation that is not just a philosophical.
Yeah, I just want to make two comments to that. Number one, in the Section 8 context, at least the landlord's continuing to get the Section 8 money, whereas if it's a tenant who's not on Section 8 and they default, they're getting nothing. Number two, the Lachey's argument, that's the landlord's issue. It's a strategic decision whether to continue and hope that the tenant starts paying or not. I mean, that's going to arise in any situation where there's a rent default. Mr. Harkin and then Ms. Tanner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm hearing a lot today and have been hearing over this conversation from both our colleagues and the public, and the landlord has to hire an attorney, and the landlord has to hire an attorney. Let's think about the source of this legislation. When I was with AHOME, we had dozens and dozens of people come to us who said they'd had a voucher for over a year, and because landlords would not take their voucher, they were homeless or soon to be homeless. They didn't have the money to hire an attorney. So, you know, let's not bash and objectify the tenants on Section 8 and keep this as a one-sided argument about how we're victimizing landlords here. The purpose of why we're even having this discussion is because there are a number of people who've been unable to use their Section 8 voucher, and these are folks who can't afford lawyers. Okay, so let's not play the victim card with this person has to hire a lawyer and that person has to hire a lawyer. The people we're trying to protect with this legislation, by and large, can hire lawyers. So let's just keep the record clear and let's just keep the record even. That it goes both ways when we play the victim of who has to hire a lawyer.
Any other comments? Mary Lynn, I think we need some, at this point, I'd just like to introduce some changes I think we need to make to the existing statute. Oh, sorry. Yes, sir.
Can I get a little bit?
Just to respond to that.
Fair enough.
Yeah, they can. We deal with legal lawyers all the time.
We pay for it.
Always in court and available. The people who genuinely require an attorney have attorneys available to them at no cost.
That's not true.
So I think that's not an invalid argument.
Changes. First of all, we'd like to get the list of, in the committee report, a list of all programs we can identify, federal, state, local, that would fall within the definition of income derived from a local, federal, state, or local public assistance or housing assistance grant or loan program. And then we want to, we talked last time about exempting not only co-ops but condominiums. That needs to be put in the law. Okay. And then I think we need to strike
just co-ops. What section are you out of the co-ops?
Oh, three. The section 3B3.
Okay.
In the law itself.
Yeah, it says provisions of this article shall be applicable to all housing accommodations with the following exceptions. Cooperative apartments, you need to add condominiums. And then it says housing accommodations otherwise exempt, housing accommodations.
So we would say cooperative and condominium.
Well, you could make it 7B condominiums. I would make it 7.
All right.
And then in section Roman 5, the source of income definition, we're going to strike annuities, pensions, and child and spousal support.
Where is that?
Roman 5. Under section
5. So we're striking annuities.
Striking pensions and striking child and spousal support.
And annuities?
Yeah.
Eluding court ordered payments?
And strike court ordered payments, too, because somebody could stop taking the payment.
Yeah. I'm sorry, it says letter 5.
Now before we move to the next question, does anybody have any other proposed amendments to the draft law?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I would raise the issue, if you've already discussed it, making this a freestanding law. We had that discussion last time, and we were going to have a discussion on it. Whenever you think it's appropriate, I just want to make sure that we do that.
Does that
have to be
sunshine
today?
Sunshine?
Yeah, explain what you mean by that.
Instead of making it an amendment to the human rights law, just make this a freestanding law so it's enforced by the individual person as opposed to the Human Rights Commission.
I think it's more effectively, based upon what we hear from Nassau County, these things generally get conciliated, and rather than have a lawsuit be brought, it makes sense to try to resolve it in a more amicable way.
I raise the issue. I don't know.
Mr. Chairman, you know, I had raised with, I think, the chairman months ago, because some of the information, and it may be in the preamble here, I forget already, about Chicago and millions of things. There's all kinds of numbers. There's nothing Westchester specific. I was a little surprised, I have to say, hearing from Nassau County, 15 phone calls a week or 30 a week, it just seemed overwhelming. Could we, again, if this committee is determined to move forward on this, it seems to me the legislative history and the intention, not talk about Chicago and national statistics, all this, find out what's going on. I can tell the Section 8 office of Portchester, when it was there, they had no problem. I mean, they didn't come to me. We heard Nassau, honestly, she said, terrible problem, go to solve the problem. I think, just to be legit, and there's all this anecdotal, there's problems that we're all hearing problems. How many calls a week is our Human Rights Commission getting on this? That should be an easy one to answer. And I'm asking the question without knowing the answer. They may be getting 40 calls a week.
Our Human Rights Commission may not be getting calls because it's not under their jurisdiction.
Housing is.
Wait, I would take out the sentence.
They were getting calls before the law. They were getting calls. That's why they passed the law. I just think in the record, you should know what the problem is.
By the Lawyers Committee for Better Housing.
Where are we talking? Sure.
It's in the committee report.
Second page. Take out Chicago. We don't care about.
Well, but beyond that, we should, we talk about the U.S. Census, 8.7 million out of 20 million are not accepted. That's all wonderful. Census, U.S. wide. Can we have those numbers for Westchester?
Well, we're passing a Westchester. With respect to Westchester, the committee has received testimony, which we have all heard, that Section 8 holders have significant fewer housing options.
Well, we've heard that, but again, have our Human Rights Commission gotten any phone calls? I mean,
why would you get phone calls about it if...
Well, why did Nassau
get it? It's not in the jurisdiction yet.
They passed the law in reference to that. They were getting all those phone calls. They had to pass a law. That's what I understood. That's why they passed the law.
My name is Barry Kramer. I'm the vice chair of the Human Rights Commission. The source of income is not in our law currently, so why would anybody call the Human Rights Commission?
Well, if housing discrimination is under your law now. They were getting all those phone calls before the law.
Yes. That's what I'm saying.
All right.
But that would be the Nassau
community,
right?
All right. All right, so I want to know what our commission is.
All right, Mr. Nunziata and Ms. Townsend.
I don't know if members of the committee or the various committees remembers, but you had a very, very specific testimony from Dolores Braithwaite, I'm forgetting now, last year, where she said we get maybe, in the course of a year, maybe four or five calls. I mean, she said it was very, very, very minimal. Now, we just heard Nassau County said, people don't know about the law or whatever. I mean, when you have a problem, you call the county, and there should be some kind of documentation of this. You take documentation from advocacy groups, might tend to be suspect, but you heard testimony from Dolores Braithwaite saying it's, in terms of calls we've gotten, we've only had a handful of calls. You heard from Norma Drummond, who said that we could use more vouchers, that the Section 8 vouchers are being used. We just heard Karen Tenenbaum today say that one of the reasons why we're pushing this law are for the elderly women in apartments, already in apartments, who are spending a high percentage of their income on rent, and we'd like to have them get Section 8 so they can lower the percentage they pay on rent. That's already available. They are tenants in place. They have been part of a highly regulated rent system that has provided a service to their benefit. So, again, it's been a lot of anecdotal stuff, but what little that has been testified at these committee meetings and also the Human Rights Commission's own numbers overall, as reported by the Journal News on January 3rd, would say, there isn't a lot out there that ultimately needs to be addressed, all right? So you have the testimony there already. I would say it would be great to get census and other firmer statistics. I would agree with Mr. Rogowski, but you already have had, a lot of testimony already indicating that in the scheme of things it may not be such a big problem.
Well, I would note that we did receive a survey performed by Ms. Tenenbaum's organization that seemed to document that many landlords are refusing to accept Section 8 tenants. And I would ask that you provide that to the law department, and maybe they can reference that. And then we did see a survey that was done of landlords, and it was 50-50.
Right.
50 were in favor of the law and 50
and
were 50, against.
50 used it and 50, right. 50 decided so, not to use it.
Mr. Chairman, is the chairman of another issue.
Mr. Misano, first, since we haven't heard from you before.
Yes, and I apologize for being late. I was in court this morning in Brooklyn. It was a long drive, believe me. But nevertheless, I just want to, I won't comment on what I missed because that wouldn't be fair to all of you, but I'll comment on what I just heard. And that is the following. The brief colloquy between Tom and John about the freestanding law, I think could use a little bit more dialogue. And I'll tell you why. I've always thought since this issue was proposed that we haven't talked, that we've been, you've spent, we spent, and John in particular as the chair, spent a lot of time on the details, how this law is going to read, just still making changes right now. And I understand that. But I don't think you've looked at the bigger picture. And the bigger picture is, this is a bigger thing than I think you're giving credit for. If you look at our human rights code, our human rights law, the protected classes are not about income. They're not about economics. There's no class in the human rights law that's based on economics or income. This is a major change to our human rights court. We do it on someone's religion, their ethnicity, their status, all those kinds of things. That's who the person is. And if they're discriminated against, we all think that's horrible, and that's why we have human rights law. Now you're taking this to a whole other step by including economics. This is nothing we've never done before in history of Westchester County. It's not done in the New York State law. This is a major change to anti-discrimination law in Westchester County, and frankly, everywhere in this country. Now, source of income laws haven't caught fire across the country. There are some venues that have source of income laws, but they're a small minority. The vast majority of human rights codes in this country do not have source of income. And I would submit to you that because this is a bigger change than you've discussed, because now you're saying not only are the traditional anti-discrimination classes, you can't discriminate against them, that we all have agreed on for decades now. But now you're adding a new one. You can't discriminate based on economics. That someone has a Section 8 housing voucher or their source of their income. This is an economic question. Now you're saying discriminating against that person should be part of a human rights code. I think it's a bigger change, and I think you've given it too short shrift. That's why Tom's point about a freestanding law I was always interested in, was wondering if that might be a better way to go to handle this issue. But I understand your point about maybe the enforcement might work better in the human rights framework. I understand your point, too. I just don't think we've had this debate, because this is a big step to all of a sudden add economic status to a human rights code that doesn't have it, hasn't had it, and very few venues in the United States have it. And I think, I just don't think we've discussed this enough.
Let me just respond to you, because you make some decent points. But I think there's a very fair response to them. Number one, as far as the your argument that we haven't paid enough attention to this, we have reviewed this at 6 legislation committee meetings. We've had 2 public hearings. I think everyone has recognized that there's some fundamental philosophical differences as to whether this type of discrimination goes beyond what we've done. And everyone recognizes we're making that step, and some people disagree with it, and some people agree with it. The issue is we got to go forward one way or the other. It's up or down. I really think we owe that. Making a decision, since it's been discussed for so long, we owe it to all the stakeholders, one way or the other. As far as other jurisdictions, I mean, there are whole states that have enacted these laws: Connecticut, California, Maine, Massachusetts, New Jersey. No less a conservative state than Oklahoma, who's practically seceded from the Union, has a source of income law that covers any type of public assistance. Very broad.
But are they all in their human rights code? That was my point. You haven't said you don't have that document.
Well, Oklahoma, Title 25, discriminatory housing practice.
But as you researched, that all those are part of the human rights code and made a protected class under human rights law. I mean, that's something I was curious about. The state might have a freestanding law.
You have Oklahoma?
The point is, some of those states may have a freestanding law.
It prohibits discrimination based upon source of income.
But, my John, I'm saying they might be part of a freestanding law.
Yeah, but
I don't know if anyone's done that due diligence.
So,
what
do you think is widely held?
Yeah, but we don't have the actual statute.
It
isn't.
But is every one of those laws add a protected class to the human rights law? I don't think that question's been answered.
It says it is.
Everyone.
Yes. excuse me, one discussion. It shall be an unlawful discriminatory housing practice for any person or any agent or employee of such person to refuse to consider as a valid source of income any public assistance, alimony, or child support awarded by a court when that source can be verified as to amount, length of time received, regularity received, blah, blah, blah. But it's an unlawful discriminatory housing practice.
But that sounds like a freestanding law. That's my point. You've just made my point. That's a free. That does not amend their state human rights code.
So what?
That's Tom's point.
So what?
You've never discussed this in this committee, John.
So what?
You didn't even know until you just read that.
It doesn't matter.
You didn't even know.
Discriminatory.
You just made my point that you didn't even do the due diligence. You didn't even know.
Yes,
that was a freestanding law. My exact point. And that's
no,
why I say
not necessarily a priest.
Does that amend the human rights code?
It says it's an unlawful discriminatory practice.
Does it say it amends the human rights
your
code?
Your argument is we're making something.
My argument is you didn't do your due diligence.
No, no,
that is my argument.
Stop playing games.
I think you now have an admission that
games.
You didn't.
Stop playing games. Your argument
No, you're
was,
playing games.
No,
you're pushing this thing through and you're not doing
I'm
due
not
diligence.
Pushing, you can vote any way you want.
No, you're pushing it
Let
through without due diligence.
Point.
And that's my criticism.
Let me make my point. You made the point that we haven't shown that the Oklahoma law makes it a discriminatory practice. It makes it a discriminatory practice.
No, it's not
practice.
What I said. That's not it's not what I said, John. You want to play games, you just can't.
Then
not what I said.
My point is, it's irrelevant whether it's in the human rights law or not if it makes it a discriminatory practice.
And now you're going to go through all those other states, too, and look at that, too, because you apparently don't know that either.
It doesn't really matter. That's because it's irrelevant. It's irrelevant. I've read those laws. You haven't read them.
You don't know what they said.
The point is,
you proved you don't know what they
said. Where do we go from here?
Can I suggest that I would like to see and explore whether it is possible to make it a freestanding law, because it might make it easier for some people to support, and maybe the industry would support it as a compromise.
Why? Why would they care?
What is a freestanding law? I mean, someone will have to go to court.
Can I just respectfully suggest that I've made suggestions in the past. Why would somebody want to do this? Why would somebody want to do that? It has happened in the past that my suggestions are based on information that I garner by making my own phone calls and talking to people myself. So I can't reveal the basis as to why, but I just have a sense that when I'm talking to the different sides on this, that maybe one way of compromising it is to make it a freestanding law. Am I sure that's going to happen? No. But perhaps if the chairman explored it with the industry, maybe we'd be able to come up with a law. Now that you're making so many other changes to it, it is becoming much more acceptable. It's becoming much more acceptable to me. I'm finding it a lot less onerous. And all I'm saying is that perhaps some offline discussions, maybe we can
look
at something we could all
look. Do you think you would accept as a freestanding law?
They've got to go back and see, but that's just making the proposal.
I'll tell you one thing. It has been characterized to members of this board that the industry supports this bill as is, and we have no problem, and that is a flat, outright.
I don't know who said that.
The industry supports.
I just want to address a couple different things, if I could. I appreciate your giving the public and myself as much time as you have. But to the initial question that you asked about the state statutes, I think what's interesting is, putting aside for a moment whether they're in the human rights law or not, there is, at a minimum, a diversity, even among what's provided here, as to whether Section 8 or federal subsidies are the type of thing anticipated to be included in income, source of income for purposes of discrimination. And in particular, you've got the Oregon statute, which says it does not include federal payments. So you have, I don't think this, while interesting, I don't think this document provides any uniformity or consensus as to the direction that such a statute would go.
And well, Oregon's the only one that specifically excludes
Section 8. I agree, let me back up. California actually, interestingly, defines it as income paid directly to a tenant or paid to a representative of a tenant, which is a different...
So it's broader. Concept. It's broader.
Yeah, but the interesting thing about that is one of the key objections that we have to Section 8 is that it's not paid to the tenant. I think if it was paid to the tenant and the landlord didn't have to deal with it and the tenant got the money and paid it to the landlords, you would not have the people...
So there'd be no regulation.
Yeah, but you're in better... The landlord's in better position because they're getting the money directly from Section 8.
John, it's not the money, it's the regulation that's the problem.
That is not true. Because we expect that when we have a tenant, that the tenant is going to pay the rent, or there will be legal ramification for that. the objection is to the additional layers of bureaucracy and paperwork that are incumbent in the Section 8. That having been said, I'm simply pointing out the disparity among what's been provided here. And I think one of the reasons for the disparity, I would expect, might be the differing results of their independent investigations by their legislative and executive bodies. And I found what's lacking here is the fact that there hasn't been any independent verification of the need, in the sense that, for instance, Nassau County, when she explained that they were getting 35 calls per week before they passed the statute, I mean, they had a constituency with a problem that was crying out to them that needed to be solved, and there is a major disparity between that and what we've got here. And with all due respect to Ms. Tannenbaum, I don't believe this committee should be relying on any third-party agency lobbying group to provide the statistical basis for a law or a statute. I believe, and my feeling is that you've undertaken your own investigation to whatever extent you have by having your own professionals come, and what they've elucidated is, in fact, that there's not a problem in the same sense that there evidently was in Nassau County. I did review the study that Ms. Tannenbaum did. I believe it to be flawed extensively. It is completely non-reproducible scientifically. It is not statistically based, and it is anecdotal. But putting that aside, whatever my concerns are, I think the biggest point is it wasn't a study that was commissioned or performed by the County Board of Legislators or the executive branch, which I think is really where the responsibility lies for determining statistical underpinnings of the supposed problem. And the last thing, not to jump into the fray totally, but I think there is a distinction between human rights laws and other laws, in the sense that human rights laws are intended, in my mind, to address what we basically consider to be invidious discrimination based on race, religion, and certain personal characteristics which cannot be changed and which, in fact, affect an entire group. There is no specific group, I believe, that is of ethnic or other basis. So I don't think, if you just take the context of human rights in general, I think it's fair to say that the intention there is to address a certain type of what I call invidious, and courts have called invidious discrimination, which I don't think applies particularly to source of income, however you would define it.
We protect victims of spousal abuse. We protect other victims.
Marital status.
All right, I think we
Mr. Chairman, we have to get
all right. Yes.
I'd like to say one thing, and then I'll make a motion if you would entertain it. We've had extensive testimony over the course of several months, laying out what this issue is. So, I for one, and have personal experience with this, don't appreciate being lectured to by opponents of this bill that we somehow have no testimony and we should discount testimony of people we have received. People can disagree with that. That's why we're here, to discuss issues, to debate issues. But I'm not going to sit here and be lectured by people who say we've received no testimony and that there is no problem. I don't accept that premise, and I won't accept that premise. You know, the other thing is we talk about compromise. We've had several meetings to attempt to compromise. The chair of the board, then chair of the committee, Legislator Burton, and I met with the industry to forge consensus. We put several things on the table. We doubled the exemption from 4 to 8 units. We took co-ops and condos out, and yet we've gotten nothing in return. So I don't necessarily see where the compromise and the consensus is going to come. I agree with the chair that at some point we need to just do this up or down. I don't see that we're getting closer. Everybody's opinion is known on this issue. Everybody seems fairly entrenched. We've made some changes again. I would move this for a public hearing.
All purposes.
I would move this for all purposes. And then, you know, we'll have the mega public hearing. And then you know, we'll see what happens after that.
I thought you asked for change. I mean, I didn't know. I mean, Gordon Burroughs has left for one. There was no notice that we were going to vote. You've asked for some changes to be made to the legislation. We don't even have the final legislation in front of us.
Pending.
I would ask.
Gordon left. I mean, we didn't know we were voting.
We've spent 2 years.
Did you advise people that we're going to vote today? I mean, Mr. Ryan just left.
I've been at plenty of legislation committee meetings where there's been votes, and I wasn't advised in advance that there'd be a vote on taken on the legislation. I've never seen that or heard that before. And the changes we made today was to actually narrow the law, to make it narrower. It hasn't been made, it's been made narrower. I appreciate legislator Benantes and Mezano's comments about a freestanding law, but I don't think that is a material difference.
I think it's significant.
It's going to require a court action instead of an administrative proceeding, which I think, you know, makes it even more of a problem for landlords and tenants. So let's take a vote. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, one, I just want to make clear for the record. In our little battle we had, do not believe you haven't done due diligence on the merits of the actual legislation. I only believe there's no due diligence.
Here's my point.
I understand that. I understand that. I don't think that's what I was saying. In the emotions, if I said that, I didn't mean it. I do think we haven't done the due diligence on the freestanding law question and the merits of both approaches. I do believe that, and I will continue to believe that. We can disagree on that. That's fine. Number one. Number two, I just want to add one point. I don't think that's what Peter was just saying, but I do have a problem putting things in a committee report based on surveys that are unscientific. I mean, I'm not saying that they shouldn't be in there at all. I mean, from either side, frankly. You shouldn't be putting unscientific studies as a basis of how you're taking a vote.
Fair comment for. That's a fair comment.
Yeah, I wasn't talking about committee report. I'm talking about
comment. But you said to put that in the committee
report. Let's not. That's a fair comment.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, my question is on the definition of, it's clear we're trying to say four families and less are not covered. Correct? Four families. I, for the life of me, I can't figure out this double negative.
What double negative?
For not
all right, Mr. Chair, with due respect, we're a half hour late for the Environment Committee.
I think it's clear.
Can I ask that this be revised and then we consider this at the next meeting? But I don't know what that means, for not more than. I mean,
could we vote this out and then follow up with this at next Monday's Legislation Committee meeting?
I'd support that.
Well, once you vote on it.
Once you voted on it, you've got...
Can you just elucidate why you think this isn't clear?
I'm not sure what for not more than means.
Ha.
No, it's actually, that's just the opposite. That's my point. It reads like it's five. But this is an exception for those people, I think, with four families
or less. That was taken right out of the previous law with the four. That's an exact lift of language.
That's Mrs. Murphy's objection.
That was you.
I wouldn't address it that way.
That was the exact lift.
Can we check?
When we expand
that was yours.
Excuse me. When we excuse me. I'm trying to clarify for you. When we expanded the previous fair housing law, that was the exact language. The exemption was not more than four units. We lifted that exact same language. For this.
But I didn't draft that language.
Didn't draft it. That was from the federal statute.
The accusation.
No, it's not.
The accusation.
That's where we got it from.
For not more than.
I mean, we've had 2 years, and now we're getting back to wordsmithing again.
Right.
And we have a committee meeting that we're half hour late.
Okay.
Got
so let's take
them
all.
Okay.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
6-3.
I'm not sure I didn't vote yet.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Well, to get back to John.
All right, it's 5-3. We're waiting for Vito, Legislator Pinto's vote.
I'm still without prejudice.
Without prejudice.
Thank you.
But I have a concern about prejudice.
Motion to close?
So move.
Second, all in favor?
Aye.
About 1 minute.
We're about minutes. We're going to do a minute.
Yes.
Two sets of minutes, John.
Yeah, we do the next time. We can do it.
We have all kinds of minutes.
I didn't have a chance to read it.
Vito, you could have held it for a minute.
This one, there are a couple of small
ones. I don't really care. Not more than.
It doesn't affect me.
No, I want to sign it with
No, we don't sign it.
Yes, we do.
Maybe I'll sign with
me. What, you sign with a note?
Yeah.
How are you on record then? You have to be on record.
How do you on record?
You don't have to be on record. You don't have to be on record.
No, he should be. I just don't see it as a civil rights issue.
Yeah.